Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents China, Fragile Superpower by Susan L. Shirk. Narrated by Kyle Tate. Preface. The publication of this paperback edition of China, Fragile Superpower follows upon and coincides with three major events in China. It follows upon the protests in Tibet, and the horrific and tragic earthquake in Sichuan province, with their aftershocks and repercussions, and it coincides with the 2008 Beijing Olympics. All of them are of immense significance for China's leaders and citizens. I'll start with the Olympics because they set the stage for the dramatic crises that have challenged China's leaders at home and abroad during the lead-up to the Games. The Chinese government set its sights on the 2000 Olympics in 1990, just a little more than a decade after it launched its highly successful economic reforms and opened itself to world trade and investment. Hosting the Olympics would honor China as a global power after more than a century of humiliating weakness. It would strengthen national pride and bolster popular support of the Chinese government and Communist Party. For 3 years, Beijing stirred up popular enthusiasm for its bid with rallies and billboards. But the U.S. Congress voted to oppose China's bid, and the International Olympic Committee withheld the prize. In the aftermath of the 1989 violent suppression of student pro-democracy demonstrations in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and other Chinese cities, the world appeared unwilling to grant legitimacy to a country with such an abysmal human rights record. The Chinese public felt robbed and blamed America. In 2002, when China successfully won the bid for the 2008 Games, there was widespread public elation and a sense of vindication. Beijing spared no expense in constructing state-of-the-art stadiums and gymnasiums, airport terminals and subways, designed by the world's leading architects and engineers. In a frenetic drive for urban renewal, old neighborhoods were bulldozed to make way for glittering skyscrapers and shopping malls. The greatest challenge was Beijing's severe air pollution. The authorities moved factories far outside the city and planned to reduce activities in surrounding provinces as well as traffic inside the city during the games. All construction had to be completed months ahead of time to give the dust time to settle. China's leaders want the world to admire what an advanced country they have created. As a rising power determined to reassure other countries that it isn't a threat, China has become more self-conscious about its international reputation than any other country in the world. And the Olympic Games are the best chance the nation will have in a long time to shape its image. Yet even with the eyes of the world upon them, China's leaders have shied away from the political reforms that could have won them more praise than their beautiful facilities. The 1988 Seoul Olympics spurred South Korea's transition from an authoritarian military regime to a civilian democracy. Nothing of the sort has happened in China, however. Its leaders are too afraid of their own people to risk giving them a greater political voice. At the 17th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party in October 2007, there was a lot of talk about democracy within the party, but no significant progress toward allowing party members or mid-level officials to vote for the top posts within the party, as Vietnam, for example, is now doing. The Chinese oligarchy continued its traditional practice of leadership succession behind closed doors. They compromised on a package deal that elevated a number of younger leaders into the top ranks and picked Xi Jinping, the one of them conspicuously not associated with current leader Hu Jintao or anyone else, to become number one when Hu steps down 5 years from now. Nor has electoral democracy been introduced at lower levels, except in villages, which are not units of government. Elections at the next highest level, the township, have been banned. During the year preceding the Games, the authorities sought to ensure that there would be no unpleasant political surprises by tightening up restrictions on non-governmental organizations, including religious groups, the media, and the internet. despite all their focus on control. China's officials appeared to have been caught by surprise by the March 2008 demonstrations in Tibet and the Tibetan communities of Western China. When Chinese posting on the internet reacted with outrage against not only the protesters' violent attacks on Chinese shopkeepers in Lhasa, but also the feebleness of the government's response, the leaders defended themselves by getting out in front of the upsurge of nationalism. The propaganda authorities deflected people's anger away from the government onto the Tibetan separatists and the Western media, which they accused of biased reporting. The Chinese media vilified the Dalai Lama with rhetoric of the sort that hadn't been heard in China since the Cultural Revolution. They called the Tibetan spiritual leader a wolf in monk's robes, a devil with a human face but the heart of a beast, and the struggle against him a life-and-death battle. The Chinese public loved it, but foreigners were repelled by this glimpse of China's nationalistic side, so far from the image of a cosmopolitan and harmonious society that Beijing had hoped to present to the world during the Olympics. A second pre-Olympic shock occurred in May when an earthquake of 8.0 magnitude jolted Sichuan province, killing more than 70,000 people and leaving millions homeless. The Chinese government's rapid and well-organized rescue and relief efforts, and its willingness to accept international aid, won it international approval and sympathy, especially in light of the contrast to the brutal and secretive military regime in Burma that had rejected international aid for its cyclone victims a few weeks earlier. Television images of Premier Wen Jiabao, who had rushed to Sichuan to lead the rescue efforts and encourage the children trapped under the debris, put a human face on the current Chinese leadership's compassionate communism. The Tibet issue disappeared from the front pages of foreign newspapers and was replaced by praise for the valiant Chinese relief efforts and the unprecedented press openness and social volunteerism that accompanied them. You can't keep an earthquake secret, no matter how much effort you put into controlling the media. Journalists and editors ignored the initial ban from the propaganda department and rushed to the scene of the disaster because it was just too big a story for commercial media to ignore. Once the market-oriented media reported the story, the official media, like the Xinhua News Service, provided more detailed information than ever before. If people can't get accurate and detailed information about a disaster, they may panic and interfere with emergency response. The earthquake forced the government to permit greater transparency than ever before. In the aftermath of the disaster, a powerful sense of identification with the victims of the earthquake evoked a spontaneous upsurge of volunteerism among ordinary Chinese. People all over the country donated food, tents, clothing, and money, and drove to Sichuan in their own cars to deliver the aid and volunteer in the relief efforts. For the first time, people experienced what a genuine Chinese civil society, free of government restrictions, might feel like. Will the greater openness imposed by the earthquake on Chinese leaders give them the confidence to allow it to continue after the emergency ends? Or will the bureaucracies responsible for controlling the media and social organizations go back to business as usual? It is too early to know for sure. The Tibet demonstrations and the earthquake strengthened popular identification with the Beijing government, but also raised expectations for freer information and civic action that will be hard for the government to deny. This series of domestic crises on the eve of the Olympics highlights the fragility of China's political fabric, which is the subject of this book. I believe that China's leaders sincerely desire for China to rise peacefully, without provoking conflict with the United States or other countries. On issues like North Korea or India that do not attract much public attention, Chinese foreign policies are increasingly statesmanlike. But the question that troubles me, and that motivated this book, is whether this constructive international stance is sustainable within China, where nationalism is intensifying, mass protests are growing, and the availability of information through the internet and commercial media is expanding. I hope that by better understanding the complex dynamics of China's own domestic politics, decision makers in the United States and other countries will be able to devise wiser policies, policies that will enable China to act like the responsible power it declares itself to be. 1. Strong abroad, but fragile at home. As the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State responsible for American relations with China in the Clinton administration, I constantly worried about the risk of war between the two nuclear powers. A war between China and the United States is terrifying to contemplate. China's Asian neighbors would be on the front line, and people all over the world would feel the shockwaves. When I left the government and resumed my job as a university professor, these worries continued to haunt me. I can still imagine receiving the dreaded phone call from the State Department Operations Center. The Pentagon just informed us that a Chinese Su-27 jet fighter and a Taiwanese F-16 jet fighter have collided in the Taiwan Strait. My heart sinks. I have heard that the military aircraft patrolling the narrow body of water between the island of Taiwan and the Chinese mainland fly dangerously close to one another, despite U.S. warnings to the two sides. What about the pilots? I ask. Have they bailed out? Been rescued? We don't know yet, says the op center voice. Has either side made a public statement or communicated with us? Have we seen any military moves from either side? No information yet, ma'am, but CNN is just reporting it now. I dash to my car and speed back to the State Department, using the moments of calm before entering the storm of the crisis to make a plan. What should our government do to prevent the accident from triggering a war between China and Taiwan, and very likely drawing in the United States? I play through the various scenarios, and they all have one common thread. If CNN is broadcasting the news of the crash, it is sure to be picked up and spread by the internet in China before the Communist Party censors can block it out. And once the news is public, China's leaders will feel compelled by the pressure of public opinion to react forcefully. A forceful reaction is not beyond the pale. Flashpoints for military clashes between China and the United States have multiplied in recent years. And although most Americans have forgotten, China and the United States came to the brink of war in 1996. The Chinese launched massive military exercises and shot missiles into the waters outside Taiwan's ports to demonstrate their fury at our allowing Taiwan's president to visit the United States for the first time since we de-recognized Taiwan and established diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China in 1979. Envisioning the scenario as it unfolds, when I reach my office in the State Department, I learn that President Hu Jintao has already appeared on China Central Television. My fellow countrymen, earlier today a Taiwan Air Force plane flew across the midline of the Taiwan Strait, veering into a People's Liberation Army Air Force jet and causing it to crash into the sea, killing its brave pilot. This flagrant and barbarous act was a deliberate provocation by the Taiwan authorities to provoke antagonism across the Taiwan Strait and undermine the status quo. The mainland and Taiwan belong to one and the same China. Following the pattern of previous crises, the Chinese leaders have immediately framed the situation as an international attack on China and boxed themselves into a corner. Now, how will they prove their determination to defend the national honor against this deliberate provocation? Taiwan is an issue that arouses intense nationalist emotions in China. The Japanese colonized the island from 1895 to 1945, when China was too weak to resist, during a period that the People's Republic of China, PRC, school textbooks describe as China's century of humiliation. Ever since 1949, when the Chinese Civil War ended with a communist victory and the defeated Kuomintang retreated to Taiwan, Chinese schoolchildren have been taught that the century of humiliation would finally end only when Taiwan was reunified with the mainland. It is widely believed in China and abroad that if the communist regime allows Taiwan to declare formal independence without putting up a fight, the outraged public will bring down the regime. China's military and political leaders know full well that the United States, while not legally bound to intervene, has committed morally and politically to help Taiwan defend itself. They also realize that China's booming economy would be the first casualty in any military conflict with Taiwan and the United States. Nevertheless, they would use force to avoid domestic humiliation if they believed their political survival depended on it. After consulting with the Secretary of State, I call the National Security Council staff. We agree that the president should immediately telephone China's president to urge him not to mobilize the military or to make any public threats against Taiwan. Forget about using the foreign ministry channel. We have to get straight to China's top leader, who will be feeling the heat domestically as well as internationally. And only our president can reach their president. For our part, we will intercede with the Taiwan government and ask it not to mobilize its military forces and to return the mainland crew promptly. It is too late. American intelligence reports that China has mobilized not only its regular military forces, but also its internal security forces. Angry Chinese students are swarming into Beijing's Tiananmen Square and the central squares of other Chinese cities, shouting, "Down with the Taiwan separatists!" Some in the crowds carry hastily made signs saying, "Down with the America-loving Chinese Communist Party toadies!" and "When will China finally stand up?" This scene is hypothetical, but it is not a fantasy. Crises like this have happened in the past and could happen in the future. Taiwan is just a hair short of being a formal ally of the United States. We are not legally obligated to come to its defense. But an American law called the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979 does require the president to view any Chinese use of force against Taiwan as a threat to the peace and security of the region, and to consult with Congress on how to react. American sympathies, especially those of members of Congress, have always lain much more with the small democratic island of Taiwan than with the communist giant China. The executive branch and the foreign policy community would worry that if U.S. forces fail to stand up to Chinese bullying, American credibility in Asia and the rest of the world would be harmed seriously. The United States has more than 70,000 soldiers in uniform deployed in Asia in order to defend our allies and deter aggression. If we don't use these soldiers to defend Taiwan, wouldn't other countries view the United States as a paper tiger? For all these reasons, any president is likely to feel compelled to respond to Chinese military actions in the Taiwan Strait by making a strong military gesture of our own, in the hopes that this show of resolve will end the crisis by forcing Beijing to de-escalate, just as it did in 1996. But the next crisis could escalate instead if the Chinese leaders believe that caving in to the United States would cause them to be humiliated domestically and put the survival of their regime at risk. Crisis escalation has a life of its own. War can result, even if no one wants it to happen. Taiwan is the most likely flashpoint for a military clash between China and the United States, but it is not the only one. Relations between China and America's close ally, Japan, have grown dangerously acrimonious over the past several years. Chinese People's Liberation Navy vessels have begun patrolling in waters in the East China Sea near the Diaoyu Islands, which are claimed by both China and Japan. A maritime incident could spin out of control if Chinese and Japanese politicians feel pushed by hostile public opinion. China's neighbor and former ally North Korea has tested long-range missiles and nuclear weapons. So far, negotiations have failed to solve the problem, and international economic sanctions are squeezing the regime. If North Korea collapses violently and sends thousands of refugees fleeing into northeast China, Beijing might send troops into the country to restore order over the objections of South Korea and the United States. In a situation like one of these, China's leaders may not be able to manage the domestic pressures that could drive them into an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with the United States. China rising. China is re-emerging as a major power after 150 years of being a weak player on the world stage, a brief hiatus in China's long history. For 2,000 years, until the late 19th century when it was overtaken by the United States, China had the largest economy in the world. Since 1978, by shedding central planning, creating a market economy, and opening to the world, China has revived itself as an economic powerhouse and a world power. The CIA forecasts that by the middle of the 21st century, China's economy will once again surpass the United States economy in size, although its per capita income will still be much lower than that in the United States. History teaches us that rising powers are likely to provoke war. The ancient historian Thucydides identified the fear that a rising Athens inspired in other states as the cause of the Peloponnesian War. In the 20th century, rising powers Germany and Japan were the cause of two devastating world wars. Are China and America doomed to become enemies in the 21st century? Inevitably, as China moves up the economic and technological ladder, it will compete with America and expand its global reach. But a much graver danger is that as China rises in power, the United States will misread and mishandle it, so that we find ourselves embroiled in a hostile relationship with it. Even if the two sides manage to avoid a shooting war, a Cold War with China would wreak havoc in the United States and throughout the world. The two countries have become economically dependent on one another. The United States is China's largest export market, buying approximately 20% of its total exports, and China loans most of the dollars it earns from trade to the U.S. government, which uses the money to cover its large budget deficits. If Washington imposed economic sanctions on China, and China retaliated by selling off some of the billions of dollars of American government debt it owns, American interest rates would shoot up, our economy would slow to a crawl, and a global recession could result. A hostile relationship with China would also make it impossible for our two countries to work together on the many global issues that affect the people of both countries, such as AIDS, avian flu epidemics, global warming, and terrorism. Our best chance of avoiding antagonism with China is to open up the black box of Chinese domestic politics, look inside, and figure out what makes China act as it does on the world stage. We find a society drastically changed by economic reforms and opening to the world. China no longer resembles the bleak People's Republic of the Mao Zedong era that was the object of our Cold War fears. The China of today looks more benign and familiar. It is less totalitarian and more capitalist, less monolithic and more diverse, less drab and more colorful, less isolated and more globalized. Yet although the transformations underway inside China give it a greater stake in international peace, they also make it more dangerous as its communist leaders struggle to maintain political control. China's leaders face a troubling paradox. The more developed and prosperous the country becomes, the more insecure and threatened they feel. The PRC today is a brittle, authoritarian regime that fears its own citizens and can only bend so far to accommodate the demands of foreign governments. A new economic rival. China's emergence as an economic superpower requires a difficult adjustment for Americans. As Chinese officials like to remind us, China today is still a developing country. Its annual income per capita is close to the bottom of the international rankings, and a small fraction of our own. Yet we feel the hot breath of this economic dragon on our backs. The steady media drumbeat of economic statistics that document China's dramatic growth is making people anxious. Every day, news reports remind us that China is the fastest-growing economy in the world, which has increased at roughly 10% annually for 2.5 decades. China has surpassed the United States as the number one destination for foreign investment and the number one exporter of information technology products. China has the largest foreign reserves in the world, over $1 trillion. China is the largest consumer of steel and cement. China is the world's third largest trading power. China exports over $200 billion more products and services to the United States than it imports from the United States, according to U.S. calculations, resulting in America's largest foreign trade deficit. As American companies move their factories offshore to China and Americans buy more imports from China, hundreds of thousands of workers in our manufacturing industries face losing their jobs. We worry about falling behind technologically as well as economically. Chinese scientists were the first to map the genome for rice, and Chinese engineers are designing new, safer nuclear power reactors and more efficient automobile engines. High-tech companies are establishing research and development facilities in China to take advantage of the brain power found there. The acquisition by a Chinese company of the personal computer unit of IBM, one of America's high-tech crown jewels, caused angst. When a Chinese oil company wanted to buy an American one, the political backlash in Washington quashed the deal. Our dependence on China to finance our huge government debt deepens our unease. Insecure leaders. China's growing economic might makes its leaders appear to loom over us like 10-feet-tall giants. But their self-image differs vastly. Dogged by the specters of Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, the revered leaders who preceded them, China's current leaders feel like midgets, struggling desperately to stay on top of a society roiled by economic change. China is stronger economically and more secure internationally than it has been since the 19th century. But paradoxically, its communist leaders have a deep sense of domestic insecurity. China may be an emerging superpower, but it is a fragile one. And it is China's internal fragility, not its economic or military strength, that presents the greatest danger to us. Unless the United States begins to understand the fears that motivate China's leaders, we face the possibility of conflict with it. Like all politicians, China's leaders are concerned first and foremost with their own political survival. They don't have to stand for election, but they face other political risks that democratic leaders do not have to worry about. A rival leader could try to oust them. A mass protest movement could rise up and overthrow them. If China's leaders were to lose the support of the military, an opposition movement could defeat them. And unlike in a democracy, the price of political defeat to China's leaders could be crushing. Political defeat could cost them and their families their livelihoods or even their lives. Chinese leaders are haunted by the fear that their days in power are numbered. They watched with foreboding as communist governments in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe collapsed almost overnight, beginning in 1989, the same year in which massive pro-democracy protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and more than 100 other cities nearly toppled communist rule in China. Jiang Zemin, who led China during the 1990s after Tiananmen, and Hu Jintao, the current leader, know that they lack the personal prestige of Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, who founded the People's Republic of China in 1949. They also recognize that 2 decades of economic reform and opening to the world have transformed Chinese society radically and created latent political challenges to communist rule. During his second inaugural address, President Bush spoke about expanding freedom across the world and placed every authoritarian regime on notice. China's leaders could not have failed to take this message personally. The worst nightmare of China's leaders is a national protest movement of discontented groups, unemployed workers, hard-pressed farmers, and students, united against the regime by the shared fervor of nationalism.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?